All units proceed to your post assignments. All units proceed to your post assignments.
Nobody likes you. And nobody's going to like you even more when you're just a weak, pathetic farming state.
You are taunting the nice people in Ukraine.
No, there's nothing nice about the people in Ukraine. They support Stepan Bandera.
He's odious.
But I mean, I don't want to joke too much about it. I mean, I know we are because that's what we do. But he's a disgusting historical figure. And it blows my mind. You know, when we talked about the Michigan event, the lady left. Remember the lady in blue with the Ukrainian thing that was asking questions? She left when I started hammering on Stepan Bandera.
Couldn't take it
because it's the truth. I was basically saying, you are a Nazi worshiping person. You're not very, don't talk to me about morality when you sit here and support a country that elevates Stepan Bandera to national hero status. They have a street in Kiev called Stepan Bandera Avenue. They have statues to this guy.
All right. That was from our last episode, our most recent one. And it generated a response from Kevin Michalitzi, who writes for us. And we've been wanting to get some debates going here on Scott Ritter Extra, but almost everybody is afraid to debate Scott. So it comes down to, ironically, to within our own family, we're going to have a little bit of a debate. I see that Scott has his game face on today. So look out, Kevin. Look at that. He's all set up. You know, like when the boxers come out and they glare at each other right before they start. Anyway, so that's what caused Kevin to write an article saying he disagrees with Scott. And let me just let everyone know that you can go to Scott Ritter Extra to see what Kevin wrote, to say why he disagrees with Scott. And then that inspired Scott to write a rebuttal to Kevin's gripe. And there are a few good Ukrainians left in Ukraine. And then Kevin responded to the rebuttal. And now we take it to the podcast. And don't worry, we'll also get to questions from the audience as per usual. This is the lightning round, which we do every Tuesday. That's when Scott answers questions from the audience in 3 minutes or less. Unlike on Friday nights, the more expansive, loquacious version where there's no time limit. And like I said, we'll get to it after this chat. So let's go to Kevin first, since Scott already expressed himself about this and it inspired you to say why you disagree. So tell us, what motivated you to write that article, Kevin?
Well, because I live very near to the conflict zone. You know, I see a lot of this on a daily basis. So I don't disagree with most of what Scott said or in his rebuttal article. But I do believe there are still some good Ukrainians left in Ukraine. So that's the short answer.
Okay. And you, in one of your articles, we inserted a photo that you provided. And I assume this is your way of driving the point home. These are the good Ukrainians. Are these random photos? Do you know these people? What was the thought exactly behind these photos?
Most of these are random photos taken fairly recently in various parts of Ukraine. It was more to drive the fact that these are the people that we, or at least I am talking about, that really aren't in a position to take up arms against their government, fight. There's sick people, there's ill people, there's old people and young people. So, you know, I just didn't want to generalize everybody into the assumption I made of what Scott's talking about.
Right.
And of course, I apologize for the assumptions that I led him to as well.
Okay. And then Scott is also using a photo to drive home his point. there. I believe that's Stepan Bandera. I think he has the same barber I have. I'm not sure. There's a slight, we both have a slightly receding hairline. Scott, let's try to zero in on where the disagreement is. I mean, I guess you're not claiming that there's zero nice people, and nor is Kevin claiming that everybody there is nice. So, I mean, is that what the disagreement comes down to? Just the number of nice people or what?
No, I mean, look, there, I have no doubt that inside what we call Ukraine today, there are individuals who are nice people. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem. If they call themselves Ukrainians and they identify as a Ukrainian nationalist, they're evil. Because what is Ukrainian nationalism? Right now, the mainstream definition of Ukrainian nationalism in Ukraine is the ideology of Stepan Bandera. And it's not, you know, flag waving, flower throwing, hey, 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 everything's okay. It's, we are a white supremacist, Aryan-like ethnic supremacy. And, you know, Bandera has said he will kill millions to promote this. This is a man who said literally to promote my idea of Ukrainian nationalism, Ukrainian nationality, I will kill millions. And he tried his best. He tried his level best to do just that, to eliminate those he viewed as the ethnic inferiors to his. And here's the irony of it all. Ukrainian nationalism, defined by a man whose parents were Greek, who was born in Poland. I mean, this is crazy. And right now in Lvov, they have a center where they're doing blood tests to test for ethnic purity, to make sure you don't have any of that orc Russian blood in you. I don't know what their standard is. I mean, if it's Bandera, then Greek is the purest nationality in Ukraine. You know, the fact is, this is a despicable man, and the Ukrainian nationalism that he defined, which is at play today in Ukraine, is an odious ideology, a hate-filled ideology, one which must be eradicated from the face of the earth. And anybody who calls himself a Ukrainian nationalist today in Ukraine is by definition saying, I support Stepan Bandera. Now, I know there's people saying, I only support the nationality aspect of it. I don't support the murder and all that. You can't separate the two. Stepan Bandera was about murdering everybody who didn't fit his definition of nationalism. And we know that the Ukrainian government uses the Bandera standard to define what Ukraine is today. And they have empowered Banderists to enforce it. They wrap people in saran wrap on poles in public view, pulling down their pants, leaving them to die, starve to death, be humiliated, have their faces painted green. You can't be a good person and walk by that. No, you walk by it and you cut them free. And if a cop comes up, you take the cop down. Good Ukrainians, there were some. They're the ones that said, hell no. They're the ones that said, we're not going to do this. They're the ones that fled to the Donbas, took up arms and fought. They're the good Ukrainians. They ain't Ukrainian anymore, though. They're Russian, which is why I say there's very few good Ukrainians left in Ukraine today.
All right. Well, Kevin, I think that Scott's indignation is righteous to the extent that he's referring to a specific segment of the population. Would you dispute that?
I will not dispute that. In fact, I don't believe Scott and I really have a disagreement. I think it's just a choice.
It's a matter of emphasis. It's a matter of emphasis, right? Yeah. What I suspected.
My wife is from Dnipropetrovsk, mm-hmm. and reality is her grandmother on one side is Russian, and her grandfather is Ukrainian, and on the other side, it's the opposite mix. So she's 50-50. So even you try to define who's a Ukrainian, you take everybody, you know, basically the east side of the Dnieper River, and you're going to find a mix of Russian blood in probably everybody.
Yeah. So there was one particular point that you two addressed, which was that when Kevin, you said something like, what are these people supposed to do? And Scott said something like, well, I'll tell you what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to take a stand. I'm paraphrasing, but that was the gist of it. Is there a disagreement there, too? I mean, it seems I don't know anything about the people in this land that we're talking about. But the way I considered as I was thinking about people here in the USA, and I imagined, here I can see that there are some people who are just like hopelessly naive. You know, they're lost, they're ignorant, they don't know what's going on. And they could be faulted for that to a degree, but that's a different sin than being immoral, you know, where, in other words, some people really, you know, if you're in some rural area, you're not really even connected to the media. You're not really, you don't know what's going on. You're just struggling to survive. That sort of person, it seems, you know, it's kind of difficult to really get all hostile towards them.
I'll jump in on that one. Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw a story that, you know, just came into Crimea today. Mm-hmm. 11 children that the Russian military took off of the front line. Just children, you know, no parents to be found. They brought them to Moscow for medical treatment. These children can't take up arms and protest. They can't, you know, be shooting at people.
So these are the people that we're talking about. We just, all right. So Scott, so it doesn't sound to me like Kevin is taking issue with your choice to emphasize the failure of people who should be doing better. Do you take issue with him showing some compassion for these people? I mean, it's just a choice of emphasis. Would you agree with that?
American soldiers going through Nazi Germany showed compassion to women and children. Mm-hmm. That doesn't absolve the society of its sins. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, in Ukraine today, and it has been since, it was heavy in Western Ukraine since the time of Bandera, and since 1992, has been permeated throughout Ukraine, a very anti-Russian animus amongst the non-Russian segment of the population. They mock, you know, the Russians are Muscovy. You know, it's to the extent, and I always hate doing this, but I'm going to do it anyways, anecdotal stories. You know, we have a huge, huge Ukrainian Jewish community here in Albany. These are people who fled the Soviet Union in the 70s and the 80s during the time of the Soviet Union. And without exception, I mean, it. The old women always speak of others, they say they're Banderists. I mean, here in the United States, they will identify the women from Western Ukraine as Banderists. You can't say that around them. They're Banderists. You know, that's a reality. The Jewish people talked about how they went to Kiev or to Lvov. They had no problem with them being Jewish, ironically. But if you identified yourself as Russian, they wouldn't talk to you. They'd ignore you. This is bred in. This is systemic. This is cultural. This is part of the Ukrainian national identity to be anti-Russian, vehemently so, which leads to what I call the eliminationist Russophobia. How does a society, decide that the Russian language is evil, outlawed? The Russian religion is evil, outlawed? Russian culture, they're tearing down statues of Pushkin. You know, Tchaikovsky, that you can't listen to his music now. Dostoevsky, I can't read. The Idiot, which would be a good book to read if you're defining people who support Bandera. On and on and on we can go. And this is okay. Where are the people coming out and saying, no, this is my copy of Tolstoy. I'm reading it. Where are the people surrounding the Russian church saying, no, freedom of religion, baby, you can't do this. It doesn't mean they support the Russian invasion. It doesn't mean anything. It means they're standing up for right versus wrong. And there's a lot of wrong going on right now. In fact, everything that's being done by the Ukrainian government today is wrong, literally wrong when it comes to Russia. If you take the laws that are being passed in Ukraine, eliminate the word Russia, insert Jew, you literally have the laws that were passed in Germany in the 1930s about the Jewish people. It's elimination Russophobia. It's rampant in Ukraine. And, you know, I understand. Look, Kevin, I agree with you on the, you know, the complex, but here's the difference. Your grandfather was alive during the Soviet Union. During the Soviet Union, there was a different concept of Ukrainian nationalism, meaning that it was a nationality, but it was part of the Soviet identity. And so there wasn't this anti-Russian aspect unless you lived in Western Ukraine, where it always has existed.
Correct.
But within the mainstream Ukraine, you could be a Ukrainian, but that didn't mean that you're anti-Russian. In fact, you were, if not pro-Russian, you didn't see the difference because you were Soviet. You were Soviet. That was your first identity. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine was taken over by the nationalists who didn't define themselves as Soviet because the Soviet Union didn't exist anymore. And instead, they allowed this perversion of the notion of nationality to dominate. Stepan Bandera started to come. And this predates Zelensky. This predates 2014. Stepan Bandera was made a hero by an earlier president. The parliament voted him in. I mean, and this is what I'm saying. This isn't a recent phenomena derived after 2014. This has been part of the modern Ukrainian national identity from the very beginning, this anti-Russian animus that has now elevated itself into elimination Russophobia, where it's okay to go shoot Russian prisoners of war because they're not human, where it's okay to hunt down Russians, to cleanse them, cleansing operations. You have Ukrainian nationalists now laughing right up front to journalists, bragging about how they're going to have to do a census afterwards to figure out how many people they killed because they lost track. They're just killing them all, killing them all. I despise Stepan Bandera. I despise the Bandera ideology, and I have no sympathy for the Ukrainian people that continue to allow it to exist. Now, children, they're always innocent. I mean, we know that. But if you turn 18 and you're not saying, I got problems with what's going on here, then you're the problem. And here's the problem. Those children are being brainwashed from day one in school, right up front. You're told to hate Russians. Now they have, since 2019, they've mainstreamed the Banderist scouting movement, the Plonk or Plank or whatever they call themselves. They're now the only one allowed to exist in Ukraine. There were two larger ones, Boy Scout affiliated groups. They're not allowed to represent the youth anymore. If you're going to have a youth program in Ukraine today, it must be with the Banderist youth movement who controls everything, funding the works. And when I say Bandera, it's not just a name or a notion. They are teaching them the hate-filled ideology of this odious character. So it is permeated in the very essence of what Ukraine is today. I used to hate the red and black flag, but I have to tell you right now, I'm hating the yellow and blue flag. Why? Because it's the same flag. It's the same flag. The people wearing that flag today are Banderists. And we have to understand that you cannot delink the Bandera ideology from the Ukrainian nationality that exists today. So that's why I say I have no sympathy. These people opted not to do anything. War has come to them. They will pay the price, and it's going to be a heavy price. But I'm not going to shed tears for them anymore. They had a chance. If you didn't want this, you should have gone to Eastern Ukraine and taken up arms. That was an option. There was a lot of people that weren't Russian that went to Eastern Ukraine and fought because they hated what was happening. I know there's some old people, there's elderly, there's people that have to care that can't make that trip. I absolve them. I absolve them because they have individual circumstances. I'm talking about people that say, I am a Ukrainian nationalist. I am a Ukrainian national. When you say that, you're buying into the Bandera ideology, and I have no use for you, just like any German who was alive during the Nazi German times. I'm sorry, you lost the war, you pay the price, you hang by the neck until dead, or you're forced into forced labor to clean up the mess. But no tears coming down my eyes for you.
All right. We heard at the end you absolve the elderly, and previously you said you absolved the children. So
before we go to children, because they're without guilt. Children are innocent.
Okay. So before we go to questions from the audience, let's give the last word to Kevin.
Well, again, I don't necessarily disagree with anything Scott says. The nationalists tend to be the the western end of Ukraine, half of Ukraine. And there are people in like the Dnipro regions, the Kharkiv regions, the Odessa regions that are not supportive of the nationalist government. But they stay there because they have husbands trapped in the country who can't leave. And a Slavic woman is not going to leave her husband, her wife, her elderly parents alone in a country, no matter what's going on. Scott knows how a Slavic woman will stand up for you in times of trouble.
My wife's Georgian.
Your wife, Jordan?
Georgian.
She's Georgian.
Yeah. But she's Slavic. So
she might take an exception to that.
Well,
she's Soviet.
She's Soviet. Okay. My wife is Soviet too. So, you know, there are exceptional people in there that I will absolve as well. I know people who just recently left Ukraine and, you know, they happened to be on, well, they didn't leave Ukraine. They were on the western side of the border when the whole conflict started. They flew to Turkey, got a visa to Canada, and they went there because he didn't want to fight on either side. You know, how do I look at a guy like that? I don't know. He didn't fight for either side. He fled the country, but, you know, he's living in Canada with his wife now. You know, I brought my own mother-in-law across the border this summer. Cost me a fortune to have her brought across the border. A Russian from Dnipro took Russian citizenship and lives on our side of the border. You know, my wife's brother, can't get him across. It would cost me a fortune, and it requires all kinds of bribes and everything else to get it done. Just can't be done. But he's stuck there. So, you know, yes, he could, you know, pick up a bat and crack a couple of neo-Nazis in the head with it and, you know, take a bullet to the back of the head. That's reality.
Well, let me just say one thing. Betty Williams, Nobel Prize winning, Peace Prize winning Irish lady. You know, she won the Nobel Prize by getting together with other housewives in Ireland, standing up to the IRA. The IRA sent an assassin to her at one point in time, and she was willing to take that bullet, but she said no more to the violence, no more to the hate. Women, mothers, wives can be a very powerful movement. You know, I'm just, you know, look, history is a harsh judge, a harsh judge. And those who take, I'm not going to call it the easy way, but yeah, the easy way, which is to do nothing, to be passive because you're afraid. I understand that. I understand fear. But this is evil that has defined your nation, has taken over your nation. And there's things that can be done. And maybe you pay the ultimate price. But, you know, that's, you know, 27 million Soviets died fighting Nazi Germany. 27 million. Not necessarily fighting. A lot of them were just slaughtered by the Nazis. I'd have a lot more positive things to say about the Ukrainians if they were taking to the street, throwing bottles and standing up and dying. I'd say these people are fighting for something that's worthy of support. But I don't have too much use for passive people because passivity is a pathology, especially in the face of evil.
All right. There's a number of people who like to express disagreement with Scott from afar, but they're afraid to debate him. So I want to use this little debate as an example. Scott got heated, very passionate. He made his point. But look, Kevin didn't crumble. So those of you who are afraid to come and debate Scott, look, are you feeling okay, Kevin? You're not going to go into therapy now and go crying. Scott, in the corner.
Scott talks about this. I can't tell you how many of the podcasts he's been on where I've heard him say it's about civil discussion, civil debate. Two people should be able to sit down, have a conversation about their agreements. You find the areas where you do agree, where it's just the wording, and you hash out the rest.
Yeah, I'll have a beer with Kevin any day of the week. I mean, just because we disagree on this issue doesn't make, you know, one of us good and one of us bad. We have a disagreement. We had a civil discussion.
Right. And speaking of having a beer, that's another disagreement we have in our little family here. And that has to do with whether or not Scott will be reinstated on Twitter. He has bet that no, he will not be. And I am betting yes. And it's a very high stakes wage. One beer. And one beer. By the time we go to Texas, which might be in February, that's the cutoff point. But before I want to mention that Kevin is going to be our guest on the other podcast tonight at 7:30 Eastern time. And we're going to get into the Elon Musk Twitter situation in more detail then. We probably shouldn't do it now because folks are expecting Scott to answer their questions. But just real quick, Scott, you should know that Kevin actually knows Elon Musk and he had a conversation with him about you. You want to just paraphrase that for him before you go?
Well, is what I can paraphrase is it's tough, even if you know the man, to ever have a discussion with him. You will be reinstated. The current word is that they will start reinstating accounts on a much faster basis in a month, possibly 2 months. They're working through all the legal issues with the EU, the US. They're getting pressure from, you know, the Democratic government right now. They're getting support from the Republican government. But I'll talk about that more in the next podcast.
Okay, Scott, and we weren't looking to bait you. I just wanted to share that piece of information with you and not argue about how quickly he should do it or not do it.
If he doesn't do it by the time you go to Texas, I will send you some Baltica from here.
Okay, boy, somebody's going to have something to drink. All right, so that's at 7:30 tonight Eastern Time, Scenes from the Evolution with Tori Mansfield and myself. Thank you so much, Kevin. We appreciate you joining us, and we know it's kind of an odd hour for you. We can say where you are, right? Crimea, I just said it.
Yep.
What time is it there?
No, don't tell anyone. It's 11:30 at night.
It's 11:30 at night. All right, so yep. It'll be even... I don't know what time it'll be later on when you join us, but thank you very much.
Yep.
Thanks,
thank
Kevin.
You for having me. I appreciate it. Thanks, Scott.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Bye.
All right, Scott, let's go to the questions. And to our audience, we appreciate you tuning in and your patience with us. We thought that would be worth including before we get to the regularly scheduled agenda. Bo from British Columbia 2 weeks ago. Oh, and also I want to acknowledge that we don't have Tori today. For the first time, Jackie Schwab is filling in for us today. And we thank you, Jackie, and welcome you. And she's handling the comments. So don't be shy about inserting those comments, Jackie. And thanks a lot for your help. Bo, British Columbia, 2 weeks ago, you were rather dismissive of the idea of billionaires having nuclear bunkers, saying that such bunkers were not tenable. If underground bunkers are unviable, then where do billionaires plan to hide and survive nuclear winter?
I don't know where they plan to hide and survive. They're not going to hide and survive. They're going to die, just like everybody else. So money ain't going to help you. When nuclear war hits, we're all equal. And radiation is a harsh reality. They're all going to die.
Yeah, so I don't think anybody has any answer to that question. And I'm not even sure. I wonder how many people really think they will survive. I mean, we may be critical of people who don't even exist. I think that's possible. I think that's called knocking down a straw man. Nobody of importance from nowhere of importance. Oh, yeah, I used to live there. That's a bad neighborhood. You seem pretty sanguine about non-Ukrainians fighting in Ukraine. Am I wrong to be concerned that one of these foreign fighters may end up committing war crimes on video and force an escalation, or is that unlikely?
Maybe I'm just a Marine. Sanguine. It is too sanguine.
Sanguine.
Sanguine?
Yeah, you know what it means, right? It means kind of not that concerned.
Yeah, you know. I don't know why anybody thinks I'm sanguine about non-Ukrainian.
Maybe if they hear you screaming about something else, but not screaming about this, the absence of screaming leads them to that, you know, by comparison.
But, I mean, we it's not a hypothetical. These foreign fighters have committed war crimes on video. We have the video. We know they're doing it. But committing a war crime isn't going to force an escalation. Azov has been committing war crimes from day one. Kraken. We can go on and on. All those Nazis we talked about. Let's get back to, Zelensky or whatever the general's name is. Just took a selfie with a Bandera picture in the back. He's a dead man too now. He's a Nazi. Everybody in his command under him is a Nazi. They're all committing war crimes. They're slaughtering Russian prisoners of war. They're, killing, hunting down Russian civilians and shooting them. It's all on videotape. No one's doing anything about it. The Russians are recording the data. Someday there will be justice, and that justice will be harsh.
Plastic Patty, an old friend of ours from Ireland. How do you see Russia satisfactorily addressing the pressing infrastructural, employment, and social needs of the areas it is to treat as part of the Russian state? Some analysts have cast doubt on Russia's economy for the foreseeable future.
Well, it's a tough problem. The Russians back in 2014, when Lugansk and Donetsk first petitioned to become part of Russia, one of the main arguments put forward by Russian economists was Russia couldn't afford to bring them in and raise them up to Russian standards. But now, you know, the situation has been, you know, it's escalated. There's a war, and Russia has a moral and legal responsibility regarding this. We saw with Crimea, where Russia, you know, absorbed Crimea, but hadn't budgeted for it. And so the Russian government turned to the various governors of the various districts throughout Russia and allocated certain areas to them. And so they sort of parceled it out and brought it up. And look at Crimea today. It's to Russian standards. Something similar will happen. You know, there will be a rebuilding. It's already happening in Mariupol. And, you know, you see these guys providing gas and infrastructure to the places that they're taking. There's a moral obligation, a legal obligation, and Russia's going to do it. It's going to be very expensive, but the Russian economy will be able to absorb this. It may not be as quick as people will want, but it will happen, unlike the three decades of decay that's taken place in Ukraine. If you weren't directly affiliated with an oligarch or some corrupt individual, your village suffered, your roads suffered, your infrastructure suffered. That didn't happen in Russia. You go in and take a time-lapse photograph of every Russian city, and you'll see from 1999, let's say, at the end of the Yeltsin period until today, nothing but improvement, nothing but modernization, nothing but good infrastructure.
Okay. A lot of good questions. I agree. Asian Jack from Southeast Asia. Bakhmut is turning into a massive meat grinder. Two capital M's there for Ukraine. Just how bad is this for the Ukrainians? And why don't they pull back to a more defendable location like the Russians did with the strategic retreat from Kherson?
Well, Bakhmut is the defensive position. It's part of a defensive belt that's been constructed by the Ukrainians over time, over 8 years. It is a massive meat grinder. But, you know, where are they going to fall back to? Kramatorsk? That's okay. Go ahead. The Russians will take that city. Once you blow through Bakhmut, you burst the defensive belt. And now you're able to get behind and roll it up. And that's basically the, you know, that's what's going on. Uh-oh, we've got another.
Our angel in Quebec.
He's, well, how, do we debate the man who gave me the computer? Isn't that a conflict of interest?
No. That proves that we are genuine and pure and real.
Okay, and bottom line is Bakhmut is a meat grinder. It's also become sort of a political battle. Both sides have put a marker down that they're gonna win this thing. So Ukrainians are pouring in resources, the Russians are pouring in resources, and you know, everybody is, you know, they're fighting for this place, and it's Ukrainians are losing a lot of guys.
Okay. Harry from Leuven, NATO. Did I say that the right way? Where's Leuven? Is that Leuven. A place?
Might be what? Germany. I don't know. Leuven, okay. Germany.
I didn't have time to look that one up. NATO is sending more weapons to Ukraine, including more air defense systems. Also a new $1 billion deal with Raytheon. They're a defense contractor, Scott, in case you didn't know. How much of an impact do you think this will make to Russia's offensive?
I mean, it's more toys for Russia to destroy. Russia's winning this war, going to win this war. There's nothing NATO can do to stop it. Good luck, send everything you want. And, you know, I think the Russians will be more than happy to destroy it and kill the people who are manning it and bankrupt NATO even more. We're beyond the point that NATO can salvage this. There's nothing NATO can do except throw more money away, which will cost Ukraine more lives. That's it. Dutch name. There we go.
David from Montreal. Will the 101st Airborne enter southern Ukraine once Ukrainian forces collapse? If yes, what happens if Russia bombs them?
No, 4,700 men, light infantry, who move around in helicopters, will not enter Ukraine because they'll all die once they enter Ukraine. It's just stupid. The United States isn't going to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. We've already said that. here we go, Russia's unstoppable, NATO's new. Hey, why don't you come on, Clinton? You're in Austin, Texas. Come on the show, have a debate with me. I mean, you're sitting here sniping long distance. You tell me how they're stoppable. You tell me how NATO's going to win. I'm interested in having a civil conversation with you. But don't snipe long distance like that. That's really not useful.
You're so sanguine sometimes.
Am I?
I think Austin was his surname, by the way, not where he lives, but go on.
I was in the post office today mailing packages. So I'm, that's not a pleasant experience. So that's why I'm a little combative.
Did you mail me the thing that I've been asking you to mail me?
No, because it came after I went to the post office, but I have it and I will mail it to you.
All right. We won't say what that is. Go on.
A love letter. if that's what happens if Russia bombs and Russia kills them all and the war is over. I mean, the United States is not going to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. That just isn't going to happen.
All right. And hang on a second. I was just fixing our timer. Horace Lim from nowhere in particular. U.S. think tanks believe they can start limited nuclear war in Europe or Asia. What do you think?
I think there's no such thing as a limited nuclear war. I think all five major declared nuclear powers agree on this. This is why they had a statement that says nuclear war cannot be won, therefore it cannot be fought. Think tanks, their job is to, throw problems out there and assess them. But policymakers understand the reality of nuclear weapons. I don't think anybody believes it can be a limited nuclear war in Europe or Asia, because in Europe, it means a nuclear war with Russia. It'll turn into a general nuclear exchange. And in Asia, it means a nuclear war with China or North Korea turns into a general nuclear exchange. What American politician is going to tell the American people? That's okay. Seattle, Denver, Los Angeles, we'll lose them. We can lose them. No.
All right. I don't want to take time away from our beloved audience, but sometime I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about think tanks, what's really behind them. And they seem to have an awful lot of funding. And I just, I know, but I mean, I'm not quite sure I understand how that results in influence that justifies all those dollars. So I'm sure there's an explanation, but let's not take time away from our beloved audience. Ash, Tacoma, Washington. How concerned should the world be about far-right extremists and neo-Nazi militias acquiring weapons through NATO's unsupervised arming of Ukraine? Should the EU expect an increase of violent hate? Can you take that comment out for a second there, Jackie, so we can read the rest of that? Should the EU expect an increase of violent hate crimes and terrorism once the special military operation is concluded? Thank you, Jackie.
I think the world should be concerned about far-right extremists and neo-Nazi militias groups acquiring weapons through NATO's unsupervised arming of Ukraine. But it's not just the unsupervised arming that's a problem. It's the the pathology of passivity. We're right now, we've created a scenario where it's norm. It's normative. It's normal to be a Nazi in Ukraine. It's okay. We don't care. Hell, bring them to Congress. Invite them into the people's house. Have the Speaker of the House go, Slava Ukraini, as if she's saying Sig Heil. She doesn't understand it because she's stupid, but that's what she's saying. The same death cry that the Banderas use when they put hundreds of people into a building, set it on fire, and cheer as they die. Slava Ukraini. These are despicable people, and we've made them normal. We've mainstreamed them. We allow them into Congress. They can wear their hate patches. They can auction off their hate patches. That is the Nazi symbology on their patches. The judicial system, the Supreme Court of Ukraine today just said, the symbols that are attached to the Galicia division, which was an SS division during World War II that committed war crimes. They're not Nazi affiliated. Don't worry. That's just national. If your court can twist its mind into saying that, it says everything about your society, how despicable you are, how despicable the people are who appointed the judges, how despicable the judges are, and the fact that there's no legal recourse to challenge this kind of nonsense. By mainstreaming that, you empower similarly inclined people throughout Europe. And if these these neo-Nazis get defeated in Europe, where are they going to go? They're going to go to Europe amongst like-minded people armed with what? The weapons we provided them that they're now selling back in Europe, stockpiling. Who knows what they're doing? Yeah. Sow the wind, reap the whirlwind. Europe, you're in for a long, long period of violence. It's your own fault.
James from Cape Town, South Africa, given the forceful priority of the U.S. to spread, quote, democracy around the world, is it plausible to conclude that the reason they do it is because democracies are easy to infiltrate, making it easier to weaken whatever government the U.S. wants?
Well, first of all, what we call democracy isn't democracy. It's you know, it's a perversion of capitalism. It's imperial in nature. Where American comes here to hear the Russian point of view. Man, Clinton, why don't we meet in a boxing ring? We can have a debate there. That's one I'd really enjoy. God, sorry, Jeff. I told you I went to the post office, so I'm a little bit of a sour.
You're going postal.
Literally, I'm going postal. But you know, democracy. That what we're selling is more about empire, economic empire. It's about economic relationships. It has nothing to do with democracy. It has everything to do with about creating a system that supplies the United States what we need at a price we want to pay, not a price what the market rate is. So that's what we're promoting. We're promoting the rules-based international order. We call it democracy, but it's not. It's the rules-based international order. And people need to understand that if you buy into this, you're buying in as a minion. You're not at the table with the big boys. There's only one person at the table. That's America. Everybody else services America. So you want to play the American democracy game? Understand what it's really about. You will be serving us forever. We don't believe in friends or ask the Germans. Ask them how that Nord Stream pipeline thing's going.
John Wayne, the Duke from London, England. Why was ISIS destroyed, but the Taliban withstood a 20-year militia onslaught from multiple nations? Is it the mountains of Afghanistan helping the Taliban, or are the Taliban just better fighters than ISIS?
Well, first of all, ISIS hasn't been destroyed. I just disagree. The Taliban and the ISIS are both, there's an ideology attached to them. Generally Wahhabist or stuff, but they also, there's an ideology that succeeds when it attaches to a tribal or some sort of ethnicity thing. So, for instance, in Afghanistan, the Taliban's power structure comes from the Pashtun tribes in eastern Afghanistan. This is where, in southern around Kandahar, this is where they thrive. So it wasn't just about defeating an ideology. You were trying to defeat tribes who are at home in the mountain where their tribal ethics and ethos supersede anything that we can bring in. We want to bring in democracy, and the chiefs are going to say, you ain't doing that. We got our own thing going on here. You want to educate women? We're not going to let you do that either. We got our own thing going on here. And they tend up, what is my information vetting process? Two jabs and a right hook.
Jackie has already picked up the hang of how to get you all that. I swear I didn't even tell her about that.
But, ISIS right now, if you go to Iraq, it's in Syria where it still exists, it's tribal. Tribes have bought into this notion. You go to Africa, it's tribal. So they haven't been defeated. You go to, you go up into Tajikistan and look where ISIS is infiltrating. It's all based upon clan structures, et cetera. It's not necessarily an ideology where you have a diverse group of people coming together saying, we all believe in this thing. It's tribal people using Islam and revolutionary Islam, extremist Islam, as a means of empowering themselves to move in on a society that they view embraces different norms and standards that they do. But neither ISIS nor the Taliban have been defeated.
All right, let's take one more of the questions that were submitted in advance. And then, so get ready, Jackie. We'll get some live questions right after that. So find us a couple of good ones if you can, Jackie. Elaine from Albion, Michigan. Are there military strategies that the Russians used to, that were adopted during the period of rule by the Mongols, which differ from European or U.S. military tactics?
You know, Elaine, I actually wrote a thesis on this. My thesis in college for Russian history was the roots of Russian military doctrine, etc. You know, when you think about the Cossacks and Cossack cavalry and things of that nature, you start to go back to methodologies that that could have been influenced by the Mongols. The concept of a nation that uses space, to buy time, patience. They were occupied by the Mongols. They outweighed people. All of this plays in. I mean, so you're talking strategy. When you get into tactics, the bottom line is that the Russians are, study the same European-based tactics that everybody else did from Peter the Great on up. They've been, even before, Catherine and all that, they used the Russian, but the mentality of being a Russian, and in a environment where you have incessant Mongol invasions is one that allows you to be a lot on the defensive, receiving the attack, weakening the attack, and then counterattacking. And so I think you see that transfers over today. The concept with NATO isn't that Russia is going to attack NATO. It's that NATO will attack Russia. Russia will receive the attack and then counterattack. And that's sort of what's happening here. The special military operation wasn't your classic, military offensive. It was something different, something special. Unemployed Marvel fan. Well, that could describe me. the fact is, Russia went on the defensive after a while. They were grinding through trying to take over parts of the Donetsk, but everywhere else they were sort of on the defensive. And then the Ukrainians attacked, and now the Russians have received the attack. Now they're building up their forces, and I think we're going to see a major counterattack. But I don't know. Clint from Austin, maybe you got a different way to interpret this. You tell me what the Russians are going to do with 200 T-90M tanks. They sit on their asses? I don't know. You know, apparently.
Of course he does. All right, you're just going to keep saying he's from Austin, even though his name is Austin.
Oh, is his name Clint Austin? It's two names?
Clinton Austin. I mean, yeah, that's how.
I apologize to the people of Austin. If we ever go there, don't hold me account.
Oh, that's our 30-second.
Did I just get my 30-second note? Okay.
I forgot to stop the clock. All right, Jackie, you got some good questions for Scott. Let's go to some of the live questions that have been coming in on Facebook and YouTube. Lou, what do you think about the Russian Air Force lack of action in Ukraine? Why aren't they ruling the skies over Ukraine?
Well, how are they not ruling the skies over? I mean, you're going to say, well, because the Ukrainians are flying helicopters and they're flying Su-25s, they're flying MiG-29s, and they're flying Su-24s, and they're getting shot down. The United States during the Gulf War had total supremacy over the skies of Iraq. And yet ask Delta Force what happened in February when the Iraqis brought helicopters up and tried to put them into a little bit of an ambush. Why, how in the hell did Iraq put helicopters in the air if we control everything? Because war is a little bit more complicated than most people think. It's tough. The Russians also don't fight air the way we fight air. The Russians, most of their fire support for the troops comes from artillery. And to what extent they do air. For instance, take a look at their profiles. I mean, I watched all the American helicopter pilots and stuff from the Gulf War and the War on Terror mocking how the Russians would come into a point, pitch up, and fire their rockets before peeling off. Then the rockets come in like artillery, because that's literally what it is. It's air artillery. But Americans were going, no, that's not precision. We got to come in up here, flip up, come down, hit them with precision, and go out. But you see, we can do that in a permissive environment where there's no air defense. Try and do that where you have the Russians with air defense. Pitch up, shot down. Hey, there goes one American airplane. Pitch up two, shot down. There goes another one. The Russians come in low, pitch up, move, and they still get some guys shot down, but not as many. They just conceive it differently. Their air interceptors, the MiG-31s, are out there flying high, and when a Ukrainian airplane comes up, they shoot them down. There's also air defense umbrellas that are out there. The Russians control the sky in a different way than we do. Just ask the Ukrainians what happened the other day. You know, they sent those two drones off, crashed in an airfield after being shot down, damaged three bombers. Then the other bombers took off and shut Ukraine right down. So I think the Russians are doing air war the way they want to do the air war, and it's working out.
All right, let's move on to our next question. By the way, we are about 5 minutes away from the one-hour mark, which is usually our cutoff point. Do you want to go a little bit over this week since we had Kevin on at the beginning, or do you want to stick to the hour? Your choice.
We can go over. We're here to serve the people.
All right. Laura Powers, Austin's sister. What about all the people who have been living, you know, Austin Powers? Get it? What about all the people who have been living in Afghanistan and Iraq who have been subject to dirty nuclear spent tube explosions?
I think she's talking about depleted uranium.
Maybe.
I don't know, because I don't know what a dirty nuclear spent tube explosion is. But I do know what depleted uranium is. And I do know that, for instance, the A-10 uses depleted uranium rounds as an armor penetrating round. I do know that the LAV-25s use 25 millimeter rounds that have some depleted uranium in them. I do know in Iraq, for instance, in Fallujah, where the United States used a lot of depleted uranium, that there is a abnormally high cancer rate amongst children, infants born with deformities. So what do I think about it? I mean, was that what the question is? What do I think about it?
I don't know. I went on to daydream since then.
Oh, so I wasn't exciting enough for you. No, what about all the people who have been living? What about all of that? What do you mean? It's horrible what's happening to them. Look, here's my take on depleted uranium. Start the clock. I mean, I'll give you 30 seconds. If I'm going to go to war, I'm going to kill you. If you're coming at me with an armored vehicle and I have an A-10 that has depleted uranium rounds, you're going to cut through your armor like knife through butter, you're going to die. Fire, kill. But we have to understand that as soon as I fire that, I have to assume moral and legal responsibility for what happens when I use that weapon. So if we're going to use that weapon, make the decision that my life is so important that we're going to use depleted uranium to save my life against an enemy, then we have to also, when the war is done, come in and clean that crap up so we don't impact the civilians that live there. It is a morally wrong thing to do, to use these weapons and then walk away as if nothing happened. A lot happened. Depleted uranium is a cancer-causing, deformity-creating poison that the United States, I believe, is morally, ethically, and fiscally responsible for. Yes, it's going to cost a lot of money, but you know what? We made that decision when we decided to weaponize depleted uranium.
All right. It's only money compared to human lives. What else we have here, Jackie? Viva la vida. Viva la vida. What is the connection between Nazis, both original and new, and the climate change green energy movements throughout history?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I haven't done any. I'm not saying there isn't. Obviously, somebody's asking that question because they believe that there might be.
It's up to the person who says there's a connection to explain the connection, not you.
Well, I guess I could go take 8 to 12 hours and dig deep. But I'm probably not going to on that one because I don't care. Not that your question isn't important, but I've got some other projects right now that have higher priority than finding out the connection between Nazis and
green. We don't say you don't care. We say you're sanguine. Don't you remember? That's the new word.
Sanguine. Old dog, new tricks. I mean, come on, give me a second.
We've got odious and sanguine, and also umbrage is another one of your favorites.
Well, I like umbrage. I use that one a lot. But now you're telling me I have to adopt sanguine. Okay, I'm sanguine about the connectivity between Nazi movements and the Green Party movement. But who knows? Now you put it in my head, and I know what's going to happen. I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight, so I'm going to be Googling the crap out of this, and then maybe I'll provide an answer. Oh, I owe somebody an answer, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I think I actually might even have that. That was the question about a petition, right?
About the ladies, the mothers and daughters committee, mothers and wives committee, a petition. The petition is real. Here's the thing. the news reference about it was a one of. They issued a press release, and then it was taken down, and they've been suppressed. That press release was picked up by a number of news people that have run with it, but it's been suppressed. But it's real. The number is real. The number is real, meaning that the petition they put in had the number 320,000. Whether the 320,000 is an accurate number is another question. There's a lot of research going on about, you know, could that number be possible? What number it is? Let's put it this way. I think there's a growing acknowledgement in the open source intelligence world that maybe 320,000 is too much. And the reason why it might be too much is a lot of these guys just might be deserters. A lot of these guys might be guys that just said, hell, I'm leaving my wife. I'm not coming home. They may still be alive. They may be living somewhere else, doing something else. Who knows? But around 200,000 of them are dead. And that's a big number, and that's unreported by the Ukrainian government.
All right, so this is Scott getting back to a question from a previous episode. He said he would look into it, but I think the question is, where can the petition be found?
You can't find it anymore. I'm telling you.
It's unfindable.
It's been taken down.
All right.
I mean, unless you have the ability to, if you took a screenshot or a snapshot or something of it when it happened, but you can't find it. I've used every conceivable search word. You know, I'm usually pretty good at dragging something out of the internet in terms of the search words. I sat there and I played with every word combination I could come with, nothing. Then I asked the question on the Telegram channel, and one of the administrators, who is, I believe, actually not a human being, but artificial intelligence, immediately came up with the answer with the links that I guess she had snapped, because she's a computer. She's a supercomputer. And she I didn't even have to wait. It was like, boom, 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 boom. This is it. And I'm like, well, God, there's the answer.
You mean it's not accessible still, but she took screenshots from when it was accessible? Is that what you're saying?
She had it at her fingertips. She said, you're not going to find it by Googling it, but here's the answers you're looking for.
Oh, okay.
I say she. It's a computer, so who knows?
Yeah, we don't know what the pronouns are for robots. Yeah,
for a computer.
Is gender an issue with a robot? Maybe. All right, you want to do three more questions, Scott?
We could do three more questions.
All right, let's do three more questions. Hocus pocus. How do think tanks influence national politics, and what justifies their exorbitant funding? Well, that was my question, so mm-hmm. Now we can address it now that it's coming from a member of the audience. This question has been on my mind for seconds.
I think you have paid operatives out there, and you throw something out, and then they come in. This is proof. You're not on my team. You're on your own team. You're running your own thing.
That was a good one.
What was that noise?
That was applause. Was it so distorted you couldn't even recognize it as applause?
I was talking, so I didn't know.
All right.
If I haven't reminded you enough.
Well, it might have been distorted. I don't know. I'll listen
back. Think tanks. Here's my thing about think tanks, my personal experience. I was recruited by Paul Wolfowitz back in 1998. They were trying to give me a sinecure. There's a nice word. A sinecure is basically they were going to stuff me in a think tank and pay me a salary to put me in a holding position until an election took place. 1998, I think you can guess which election we're talking about. It was the W. Bush crowd. They really liked me back then. And they wanted to put me in this sinecure, stuff me in a think tank to get a salary until which time I could be rotated into some sort of position in that government, which tells me that a think tank is a holding place for people to, write things, to put forward arguments, to set the stage, to create mindsets, etc., until which time they can actually be taken out of that and put into a policy making thing. And then when your time is done in the policy world, you get taken out and you get plugged back into the think tank where you basically have your sinecure. The whole idea is this is a place where people of a certain ideology come together and they don't have to do real work. All they do is sit around and have, they have panels and they have discussions and then they write papers and then this and they wear ties and they're all fancy dandy stuff. But what is the influence on that? A lot of their papers aren't really that influential. It's hard to find. I mean, the influential papers come from, the State Department, the Pentagon, and things of that nature. But these papers sometimes are you know, they generate ideas, they generate thinking. They oftentimes put it out there. There's a term, Jeff, that when you put something out and you're testing it, it's a
trial balloon.
Trial balloon. That's one word. Yeah. It's a trial balloon. You're putting out there and saying, hey, try that. Then everybody, oh, no. But see, you can do that in the think tank because I'm just academic. I'm just putting that out there. But if you do that in the government, then you have political problems because now you've been embarrassed. So sometimes they go out there and they just test things, test ideas. But the whole purpose of the think tank isn't that they're controlling policy. It's where people go to wait their next turn in the thing. And so you'll see a lot of these guys will go start at low level think tank, then go into a low level government position, medium level think tank, more boom, boom, and they bounce back and forth. And then they always finish up in a think tank, like Madeleine Albright finished up at the Public Institute in Georgetown, where she died. But she just sat there with her own little Madeleine Albright Institution, and she sat there and she polluted the minds of American youth.
Okay. So basically, it's a way to own people. You know, it makes me think of in show business, they often will give development deals to people. And then the people that get the development deals never actually get the show on. And but in the meanwhile, the network or the studio has tied up the talent so that they can't go to the competition. So it's
when I resigned, I was given a lot of offers from various think tanks, some good ones, too. But it was amazing. The second my position became more complicated, right about the time I rejected Paul Wolfowitz, offer, suddenly they couldn't. And even the ones that wanted to bring me on said, no, we want to bring you out. They got the phone call that said, if you bring Ritter on a program that we're funded, we're going to pull the money. You see, the money is designed to bring in people who fit a certain profile, who are soon going to do certain things. I lost the profile, so I never got to go get my sinecure in a think tank. We're here now, a tour of duty, our own
thing. That's right. Instead of going on with Morning Joe, that's what you've lost out on the opportunity.
This is better than Morning Joe.
Oh, that's a high jump over a low hurdle. Okay, all right, two more questions, Jackie. Let's make them good. Cat, whatever, why will the West not respond with non-conventional warfare, sound weapons, germ warfare, whatever DARPA thinks up?
Well, germ warfare would be illegal, but some people have argued that we've already have responded. The biolabs, I saw another question down there flashing below us about the biolabs. It's very disturbing. You know, we are signatories to the Biological Toxin Weapons Convention. We appear to be in violation of at least one, maybe two, articles of this convention when Russia did what you're supposed to do under the convention and appeal to the Security Council for an investigation. The United States vetoed it. So as from sound weapons, I don't know. I mean, were they give them to Ukrainians and have a bunch of Ukrainians go out there and hit the Russians with sonic waves? Who knows? I don't know what's in the mindset of these of the West.
What does a sound weapon do to people?
Sound weapon is a crowd control mechanism. Basically, first of all, it would be absolutely useless in combat. But if I have a crowd of people outside the embassy, I can sit there and come up with this microwave or something like that that I can point at them and creates this mind.
It makes it very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Do they actually hear it also, or it just is... makes them freak out?
I think it can be a combination. You can also, I mean, you know, flash bang is a sound flat, you know. If you're hiding in your room thinking you're going to get me with your pistol, you're waiting, and I throw a flash bang in there, the sound, the concussion, the sound and the flash is going to stun you, so I can come in and shoot you instead. So these are variations, so we don't have to shoot people. The idea is to make them combat ineffective or riot ineffective or demonstration ineffective.
Now, is that anything like what they do with torture? You know, there are similar torture techniques where they...
Oh, it's torture. It's torture. But the idea is to torture them until they run away. The idea is to break up the demonstration without resorting to lethal force.
Got it. All right. We have now come to the final question of this week's episode of Ask the Inspector. We made it to the end again. choosy heretics choose Carnation Revolution now? I'm already thinking this is not going to be a good question, but maybe I'll be wrong. Let's see. How was it not fascist to put the fascist hatchets on the Speaker of the House podium without a peep in 1945 after telling us we defeated fascism? Is that how we defeated it? We became it? Get the fuck out. I don't know. I have no idea what that means. Do you know? Do you?
I assume he, I don't know. It's all about symbology. I guess I have to Google it, find out. Thanks for putting another thought in my mind. Tonight I'm going to be trying to sleep like, shit, what about the hatchets? What about the hatchets on the Speaker's podium? And I got to Google it and find it and research it. And then we're going to have to address this the next time. Or we can just say, get the fuck out. I like get the fuck out.
All right. That's what we call sanguine with an attitude.
There's different levels of sanguine, apparently.
Let's bring Jackie in. Hey, Jackie, how you doing, baby? How'd it go for you? Turn your microphone on. How'd it go for you?
Jackie, I apologize.
There was a lot of comments.
Yeah,
it's a lot of bad language.
There's a lot going on here. Yeah. Wow.
Jeff, you got to remind me that Jackie's there when I swear next time. Next time I get ready to swear, you got to go, Scott, Jackie, don't swear in front of Jackie.
No worries. Don't worry about it, Scott.
Oh, I'm worried now. I'm in deep trouble. You don't understand. I have a standards committee that is going to review this.
I might have a sailor mouth too sometimes.
Thanks a lot for your help, Jackie. Jackie has made no commitment to stick with us, but giving it a try today. I won't put you
after
on the
today,
spot.
She's going to be like, Jeff, this dude's crazy. He's crazy. We're walking.
I know how you feel, though, Jeff. Okay. Those comments do fly by really fast.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And for those of you in the audience, why didn't they like my comment? It's not always that you didn't like it. It's like, but didn't have time to even read it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, thanks for having me.
Okay. And then we'll be back at 7:30 tonight with Kevin Michalitzi, and we'll be talking more about Twitter and Elon Musk. And Scott and I will be back on Friday night, and we're going to start a half an hour later than usual, 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. And so we'll see you Friday night. Thanks very much.
It'll be a remote session Friday.
Yes, a remote from an undisclosed location, correct?
From a Washington, D.C. hotel.
Well, I mentioned hotel the other night. You thought that was going too far, but now you've confirmed it. It will be a hotel.
But I didn't say which one.
No, you didn't. All right. Hopefully it's one with good security because you won't have
Maverick. Ain't coming. Maverick ain't coming, so I'm in trouble.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for all your contributions and for tuning in. We appreciate it. And thanks to Kevin Michalitzi. He's doing double duty today, coming back for our 7:30 podcast with Tori as well. See you, folks. Take care.